Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Alexander Larman about his piece in April's issue of The Critic magazine. His piece is called How to Be a Cult Writer.
Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's brilliant to talk to you.
Francesca, it's an absolute pleasure to be on.
So we're here to discuss your piece, How to Become a Cult Writer, which is in the April issue of the magazine, which is on newsstands now. So it's a piece about the status of writers who achieve either cult status or fall under that and are forgotten or are so big as they don't have cults. So to begin with, who would you define as a cult writer? What makes a cult writer separate from a very popular writer or one who's beloved by a tiny group of people?
Well, I mean, there's cult writers, then there's writers who are so obscure as to not even have a cult. I mean, it's one of the questions that I asked myself while I was writing the piece is what defines the cult these days? Because, I mean, I'll give you an example. Flann O'Brien is a really terrific writer, I mean, a fantastic comic writer, but I don't think probably more than a couple of thousand people in this country actually read Flann O'Brien. I mean, if I'm wrong about this, I'd be delighted people to write in and say, well, I like Flann O'Brien. But the thing is, Flann O'Brien was much more popular in, say, the 1960s because he was still alive or just about alive and the work was being published. But I think on the other hand, people say people like Sally Rooney and Cormac McCarthy are cult writers. So, well, no, they're not. I think there's a certain point when you're starting to sell millions of books, you cannot be a cult writer anymore because the cult has gone into the mainstream. And if you look at someone like Ian McEwan, that's a very interesting example of somebody who started off his career as a cult writer, and now he's about as mainstream as, you know, Marmite and the Royal Family. And
he still has some cult novels, though. Nobody would say The Cement Garden is their favourite novel. I might do. I do really quite like it, but yeah.
I mean, I think with McEwan, it's probably, I don't know, do you think it's Amsterdam or Atonement? I mean, what do you think was the book where he switched over from being a cult novelist into a mainstream concern?
Saturday. Huge bestseller. Everyone adored Saturday. Yeah.
And it's a dreadful book. It's probably his worst book. But that's very interesting because you see, to take someone like William Boyd, Boyd was never a cult writer. He had a big success with his first book, which is a Good Man in Africa, but it's a big, thumping mainstream book. And that took him off into a career, which actually the most cult writer-ish thing Boyd ever did was to produce a spoof biography of Nat Tate, this fictitious American painter. And that's it. That to me is what the spirit of cult writing is actually all about, that you do something which is offbeat and it is experimental, because I don't believe that to be a true cult writer, you're somebody who is working from the mainstream. I think you've got to do something that's either formally experimental, you've got to do something which is unusual. I mean, I think most cult writers, I think, as I said this in the feature, are fairly eccentric figures anyway. And they're people who might dress unconventionally and they might behave unconventionally as well. And I think the trouble is for a lot of writers, you would like, I think, I mean, I certainly would, you'd like to be a cult writer with a fanatical following than a mainstream writer with a more meh following. But the thing is now in publishing is that the age of a cult writer is behind us because there is no potential commercially for a cult writer to develop. I mean, because if I was to publish a novel which was to sell 1,000 copies, I couldn't then publish another novel. And that's a real shame because you see, back in, say, the 1930s, if you published a novel that sold 1,000 copies, but your publisher believed in you and you got some good reviews and people were writing to a publisher saying, this is marvellous, then the second book would follow. And hopefully you take your 1,000 readers, add another 1,000 readers. And so you would never become a big mainstream success, but you would have a following. Whereas I think the trouble is now is that the only way I could see becoming a cult novelist or any kind of cult writer is if you built up a reputation within another related field. I mean, for instance, to say someone like Nick Cave, I mean, I don't know. Would you say Nick Cave is, as a musician, a cult figure, or do you think he's too popular now?
I think he started off as a cult figure. I think you can look at the early Grinderman stuff and say that that isn't cultish in the way that people adore it, despite it being almost unlistenable in points. I know that you would disagree on that fact.
What do you think about Grinderman or The Birthday Party?
Well, both, indeed, actually. Birthday Party is harder.
Yeah, I mean, Birthday Party is hard. But because what I say is that Cave obviously sees himself not just as a musician, but also as a novelist, a writer, a penseur. But what I'm wondering with someone like Cave, and I mean, I think Warren Ellis, the same, do you think that you can take what they've done in terms of the music, where you've built one reputation, and then transpose that to literature, but keeping a cult reputation there?
Well, Cave is published by, isn't he published his...
And I Saw the Angel.
Published by Penguin, I think, and it's a very bad book. I mean, it is nearly unreadable, yeah.
It is nearly unreadable. I mean, The Death of Bunny Munro, which is the last novel he wrote, it's a much, much better book. And that, I think, was Canongate who published him. And again, I mean, Canongate is a smallish independent publisher based in Edinburgh. They have a degree of flexibility. It's run by this charismatic man called Jamie Bing. I mean, they are able to go out there and make decisions because they published Life of Pi, I believe. And that was what made them commercially viable as a publisher, because that is in its essence, I mean, but that is in its essence a cult book that has been brought into the status of a mainstream book. I mean, Louis de Bernier's Captain Cody's Mandolin. I mean, de Bernier's was very much a cult writer. And then this book was a massive success. But then after that, de Bernier's, who was still quite a weird figure, was writing books which were essentially attempts to write the same book all over again, and they were less good, which is why we haven't heard much about him recently.
Yeah, and if we go back to that idea of the publisher defining what a cult writer is, so Virginia Woolf you mention as a cult writer who's kind of transcended her cult status, but to what degree did the Hogarth Press and like that part of, they were, you know, cultivating, some would say, cultish writers. I mean, some of the stuff they published was brilliant and still pretty unread, but published by Persephone Books.
I would argue that what the Hogarth Press was, and the presses of that ilk, less cult, more coterie. Weren't going to get published by the Hogarth Press if you weren't known to the Wolves, if you weren't a regular at Charleston, if you weren't in that kind of milieu. And I think that's a really interesting thing. I didn't talk about this in the piece, but I should have talked about it in the piece. The distinction between the cult of writers and the coterie of writers. And the coterie writers, I think, you know, you go back to the 17th century. I mean, if you look at Rochester, Rochester has become a cult writer subsequently, but he began his writing career as a coterie writer, but he was part of this small group of Restoration wits who were passing their works on hand by hand. And so, of course, you know, when it was being printed and distributed by people who said, you've got to read this satire by Rochester, then the coterie became a cult. But I think that the coterie itself, I mean, but then we have gone back to square one. It's gone full circle again, because even now, how many people do I personally know who are only published through connections and contacts and the hand coming on the shoulder? It's quite a lot. And this goes for novelists and it goes for nonfiction as well. It's that now you would find it difficult to be published if you didn't have very serious contacts within either the literary or the journalistic worlds. And I mean, that seems to me to be wrong. But on the other hand, if you try and say this is morally wrong, people would say back to you, well, no, it's not. It's the way it's always been. But because also, I mean, how do you try and expand the pool of people being published? I mean, what do? Do competitions? Do a random thing that 1,000 people send in a manuscript and one of them gets picked and that's it? I just don't know. But I think the trouble with cult literature is that it is narrowing more and more and more by the year. And I have no idea now how you could see it, because look at Will Self. Will Self is a cult writer. But Will Self had a very strange career where his early books are weird and difficult. But then he became a figure on Shooting Stars. He became, for his short time, this almost barking mad man. Not that he was himself barking mad, but, you know, there's stories about him taking heroin on John Major's plane before the 97 election, which is, that's classic cult writer behaviour. But then also the idea that you can mix high and low, I mean, you can be around people like John Major, but also you're on Shooting Stars, but also you're a darling of a TLS poetry section. And it's something that I think you've got to have a lot of different balls in the air if you're doing something like that. And I think that somebody like Self, though, you see that he has now gone back to the cult. I mean, I would be surprised if any book he publishes now was selling a lot more copies than the sort of books that he was selling in the first instance. And so you've had a kind of parabola of a career. But should we judge a cult writer by commercial success? And I don't think we should, because I don't think we should judge artistic success by how many copies of a book you sell. Bad books sell millions of copies, good books sell 5 copies. So I suppose, what are we asking about cult literature? I mean, how do you think we should define cult literature?
I think that's such an interesting question, because when I think of the type of writers you were talking about, you mentioned some people I'd never heard of before, Alistair Crowley, Patrick Hamilton, and Mervyn Peake. But if I'm thinking about people who write weird offbeat books that are hard to understand, I initially think of like Nabokov and Pale Fire. I mean, how there's nothing more cultish than writing a book that isn't actually a book and has a poem in the middle, and you have to cut the book up to actually read it in the way that it's you're told to read it. There's nothing more cultish than that. Or David Foster Wallace. There's something so cultish about that, and yet both of them are pretty mainstream figures, I would say. I mean, Nabokov, obviously, Foster Wallace less so, but...
I'd say that both of them come in and out between the cult and the mainstream, because obviously with Nabokov, his most famous book, is now notorious because, I mean, we've never been a society that's exactly been on board with paedophiles, but now, I mean, because it's a good story, actually, of a Folio Society, which I adore, brought out an edition of Lolita about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's exceptionally scarce these days, because the Folio Society tends to cater to, you know, well-heeled, aesthetically inclined, bookish people. But it came out, and there was this feeling of, why is the Folio Society publishing this disgusting book? And if the sort of people who are buying Folio Society books were feeling that about it, then how does the mainstream public feel about it? And so we see that Nabokov's status as a cult writer is almost threatened by this outlying anomaly of this one book, which was his most mainstream book. And I mean, in some respects, Lolita is his most accessible book because it's very, very funny. And this is the thing about it that surprises people, because you expect to read a book that's going to be a sort of a dire warning about how evil a paedophile is. And the paedophile's the narrator, and he's hilarious, and he's charming, and he's likeable. He's presenting this story as if it is the great thwarted love story of our time. And it's perfectly possible to read it on more or less that level. But if you've read any other than Nabokov, you'll know that his irony and his ability to take you away from this apparent thing is so skillful. But in fact, what you see with Humbert is not the romance, or it's the utter self-delusion. And so the book's working on two entirely separate levels, which I think any good cult book should do. But first of all, you've got the narrative as presented, but then you've got, if you like, the narrative or the meta-narrative. And so, I mean, if you look at, say, Mervyn Peake, the meta-narrative is something that's going on with, because Peake always suffered from very poor mental health, and he died young. And I think you can see in the Gormenghast trilogy, which is still an underrated trilogy of books, that this fantastic imagination is coming from somewhere that's not normal. And because we talk about artists constantly. I mean, you look about Van Gogh, you look at Bacon, we look at people who are creating these astonishing works of art. But it's clearly coming from something which is not a rational place or a normal place. It's coming from something which is some part of your psyche you rather have concealed somewhere. And so I think that when we talk about cult literature, I mean, we are talking about a kind of writer who produces cult literature that is not going to be the sort of a Richard Osmonds of this world, who are going to be smiling happily and signing books and being beloved by grandmothers. What I think we're talking about instead is somebody who is probably a darker, more complex figure. And I think this is something that cuts across both women and men, actually. I mean, I don't think that men have more of a prerogative to be a cult writer than women do, or vice versa.
I think they often get more dedicated cult followings. I think the example of a cult writer, I believe, who should be greater, she has very dedicated followers, but I think she should have a wider reading, is Iris Murdoch. I mean, she has completely fallen out of fashion, but has quite a few dedicated followers and people who adore her philosophy as well.
Well, the interesting thing about Iris Murdoch is that she was incredibly popular in the 70s and 80s. And actually, she was doing essentially what someone like McEwan was doing avant la lettre. She was getting into a situation that quite difficult books like The Black Prince were selling enormous amounts. When the CVC won the Booker in 78, it was a real sense that, I mean, because we all know about her private life, we all know about the rather rackety existence that she led, but she could do what she liked. And actually, it's a really interesting example of where a man like Kingsley Amis, who was having a similarly rackety private life, got away with it. But then so did Iris Murdoch. because she was not being judged. It was not a case of double standards. She was judged by the same standards. But now it's interesting because just as we see the eclipse of Kingsley Amis, and I've written about this for the next issue of The Critic, we also see the eclipse of Iris Murdoch, who is, I think, somebody who is well overdue another renaissance. But I have no idea where or when that's going to come from, because the trouble that I think that we have with Iris Murdoch is, I mean, correct me if you don't agree, but is that we know both too much and too little about her. We know the stories about the affairs, the filthy house, the mental health and all the rest of it. But then on the other hand, what we don't know about her, I mean, because I think what has become fashionable to do with Murdoch now is to denigrate her books as little more than middle-class sagas of academia and adultery that have been gussied up with extra philosophy. But then, of course, there's a biography of her, well, a group biography of her that's just been published. Books like that are what need to bring Murdoch back into the mainstream. Because, yeah, I mean, she's become a cult writer, but that's not because she is, I think, a particularly culty figure. It's more because she's been neglected.
I don't think that you can read her philosophy from her books. I think there is something brilliantly separate in there, which is all about, like, the brilliant and the artifice of fiction. And she, I think, would disagree with saying that her philosophy is entirely present in her fiction. I mean, isn't what her philosophy is about. But yeah, fascinating to think she's just fallen completely from both public eye and public appreciation.
But then, I mean, if we go back a bit, I mean, the impetus of the article was thinking about Byron and Rochester. Rochester remains a cult figure. I tried very, very hard for Blazing Star, my 2014 biography of him, to bring him back into the mainstream. It didn't work. I mean, it was so frustrating because I thought that what Rochester deserved was to be talked about the same breath as Milton or Donne. I don't think he's any less good a poet. I think the problem has been that everybody who's heard of Rochester says the same thing. Oh, filthy, dirty Rochester, his filthy, dirty poems. And you think that's such a reductive way of looking at him, a reductive way of looking at his writing. But unfortunately, so many writers are taken down to this reductive level. I mean, look at Milton. Milton, blind, Paradise Lost, Satan's of the Devil's Party without knowing it. There you are.
But he's also as sexy as Rochester in some parts. I mean, Comus.
Well, precisely. But the thing is that Rochester was putting in obscenities and the work was obviously being shared around this court milieu, which Milton was never in. But then, you know, maybe I didn't write the book well enough. I mean, there is always the possibility. But because the funny thing is, after you've written a biography of a person you think is a major figure, and then you realise, well, it's been 8 years since it came out, it didn't reset the dial. I mean, the only thing I know that it has done is that Rochester is now being studied more at certain universities than he was. Because when I studied him at university nearly 20 years ago, he was an absolutely marginal figure. I mean, nobody studied Rochester. He wasn't lectured on, he wasn't taken seriously, he was seen as a kind of joke. Now, Rochester is being studied about the same level as George Herbert, which is not to say that he is the major writer of his time, but he's back in the conversation. And I think what I did, even if it's not that Blazing Star itself was the impetus of it, is there was enough conversation at the time. I mean, Terry Eagleton reviewed a book in the LRB, for instance, and he didn't review it particularly well, he didn't particularly care for the book. But when you've got 5,000 words by Eagleton on Rochester, you're bringing this figure back. And then I think that is translated bit by bit into the fact that, I mean, okay, it's a shame that the only place we can talk about Rochester is at university. It's a shame that we can't have more of his influence in everyday life. But then Johnny Depp, a man of good taste, played Rochester in that film, The Libertine, and it's terrible. It's a terrible, terrible film. And you think, the trouble is there's a great film to be made about Rochester, but it's not going to be made because who'd be interested in seeing it? So my hopes for the eight-part Netflix series, which I'd be writing and executive producing, have withered and died on the vine, as I say. But then you look at Byron, which of course, because actually this is what gave me the initial idea for the piece. It was that I spoke on Byron at the end of 2016 at the Byron Society's Christmas lunch, and the present-day Lord Byron literally stood up from the floor to denounce me. And it's good being denounced, because you actually feel a sense you have joined a long and noble tradition of, you know, being denounced by a member of your public. But his denunciation was essentially because he said that what I'd done in Byron's Woman, which was to present this world in which Lord Byron was not this Byronic hero, but actually he was a cynical exploiter of women. This was seen as against the Byron society and its tenets. But I'm ever thinking to myself, if the society chooses to celebrate a man like this, and they're absolutely allowed to. I mean, Byron is one of the greatest poets who ever lived. He was also an absolute shit. You have to take the one with the other. It's like, you know, I don't know if there's an Eric Gill society. There should be an Eric Gill society if there isn't. But his astonishing art has also to be taken in context of the fact that he abused his dog and raped his daughters. I mean, these things are not... And the trouble is, I feel sometimes with cult writers that we're trying to make excuses for them, that we make the excuse, oh, they're not like the rest of us. They don't have to be treated the same way. And I think to myself, well, you don't... Imagine if I was to be caught speeding later this afternoon and I was to say to the driver, well, I'm not paying the fine. I did a critic podcast this morning. I'm excused all such things for the day. I think that excuse would go about as well as you can imagine. But then I think that sometimes in society we have that thing that, because I think a lot of people don't understand what it is to be a writer, if you're not a writer, you either treat somebody in this patronising, you know, demeaning way, or you treat them with this awestruck admiration. I mean, I've had both. I mean, I've had people say things to me along the lines of, oh, so you're a writer, are you? How much do you earn? That's the most irrelevant question of all time. I mean, that's a bit like saying, oh, so you're a writer, are you? What size shoes do you take? And it's that's the kind of thing that you find yourself up against. But then on the other hand, I've had people say to me, I've never met a writer before. And you're never sure what to say about this, as if you're some species that has been kept in captivity for a long time. But then I suppose the captivity writers are kept in so often is that of a university, a matter of the institution. And I mean, while I know plenty of writers who should be in institutions and not academic ones either, I think that the cult writer has to transcend all this. They have to move between the rather prosaic realities of everyday life and be able to do something that makes them this totem for people who are interested. Because we offer this indulgence towards artists. I mean, a friend of my wife's late father, Bruce MacLean, he's an entirely eccentric man. I mean, everything that he does is dramatic. I cannot imagine that he goes down to the shop without something surreal and bizarre happening, because he is a surreal figure. But if you're a writer, you're not really allowed the same indulgence, are you? Because I suppose that we don't see the writer as an artist. We see the writer as more this figure on the margins of society, rather than because we see the artist as somebody who is allowed to demonstrate these things. Whereas if you're a writer, I mean, I can't name off the top of my head a mainstream writer who I'd call eccentric writing today.
No, I mean, Sally Rooney has been eccentric in the way she talked about not wanting attention and not wanting the prizes and everything, but she was also pretty lambasted for that. I mean, nobody was a massive fan of what she did there, but I don't think she is eccentric at all. I mean, she's eccentric in the smallest, slight way of doing that, but yeah. But I think maybe as a society, I think we're much less indulgent of eccentricity across all forms. I mean, conformism is strong.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not going to change. It's because what things like social media and the rise of mass communication have done is to superficially prize kind of licensed eccentricity, a sort of licensed foolishness. What that's also done is it's taken away the genuine eccentricity, because I think that people don't need, really know what eccentric means anymore. I mean, I'm trying to think of a public figure who isn't a writer. I mean, a man like Charles Brandreth, is he an eccentric? Well, not really. I mean, he has a booming voice and he wears silly jumpers. But that's not eccentricity. I mean, eccentricity is doing something entirely different and looking outside the mainstream, and all the things that you believe are wrong or boring or frustrating about society, but you can deal with them in this ironic and humorous way. And I think there is actually a strong correlation between cult writing and comic writing, because I think that actually a lot of cult writers are themselves very funny people, but there's often this vein of melancholy within them. I mean, you see, a man like P.G. Wodehouse, who was not a melancholic writer, is also not a cult writer. So like Evelyn Waugh, who was entirely melancholic, I think now he's become entirely a cult writer, which of course he wasn't when he was alive. And I think it's ironic that his least typical book, Brentford Visited, is by far his most successful. I mean, if you were to say to your average person, have you read Vile Bodies or have you read The Loved One? They just wouldn't have read these books.
Yeah, and Brighton Revisited is not his best. I think A Handful of Dust.
A Handful of Dust is a magnificent book. I mean, it's a great work of modernist literature, but it's not taken seriously enough because it's written by a man who wrote Brideshead. And actually, I think there's probably, hopefully we can talk about this another time, but there is an argument that Brideshead Revisited made Evelyn Waugh wealthy, destroyed his career, destroyed his life, and destroyed his reputation for posterity as well. And for a book that's got a very good first third, that's an absolute travesty. Because the first third of Brideshead is as good as anything he ever wrote. Then it goes downhill.
But I mean, the television adaptation, absolutely brilliant. Jeremy
Irons. Watch it again. The first third is brilliant. But then you don't have Anthony Andrews. You don't have John Gielgud. You don't have Nicholas Grace as Anthony Blanche. You don't have anything in it but is making it as distinctive as you remember. Because, I mean, I rewatched it not that long ago, and I was struck by how it goes from being the most glorious, witty, and you're thinking, oh, God almighty, another hour of this.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. I always think of Nancy Mitford in the same breath as I think of Evelyn Waugh, because she is funny and also not a cult writer, but there isn't at all, I think, the level of melancholy there. But she is also pretty much denigrated just for being funny, but there is something else there. There's social commentary and a brilliant irony. But yes, I think she lacks the melancholy that makes people cut writers.
What's interesting about Nancy Mitford is that Emily Mortimer wrote and directed this adaptation of Pursuit of Love. It was so bad. I mean, it was the reverse of Brideshead Revisited, actually. It was so bad, I think it's actually damaged Nancy's reputation. Because what it felt like to me was that she hadn't understood the book. And I think she thought the book was a kind of silly romance that had to be dealt with in this quirky way. And it was there was no confidence in the source material. There was no confidence in the characters. And it felt very strongly to me, I mean, the complete muck up was the character of Uncle Matthew, who is one of the great peerless comic creations of the 20th century based on Mitford's own father. But as played by Dominic West, who's miscast anyway, he's nothing more than just a standard issue bully. And you think, but you haven't understood the character. But this is a problem. Who said to Emily Mortimer, you don't actually understand the book you've read? That's the awful thing, isn't it? But the strange thing is, she's not a writer and director. She's an actress. So what I don't understand is how you've acquired the rights to The Pursuit of Love. You have said you're going to write and direct it. Nobody's said, why don't you co-write it with somebody who actually might have a better idea how to write a script? Because I suppose the trouble is that if I was to sit there patronisingly and say to Emily Mortimer, you haven't understood the book, have you? And I'd be accused of mansplaining, I'd be accused of, you know. But to me, it's not a case of being rude to a, you know, a Hollywood actress. It's more a case of you haven't actually understood what makes the book the book. I mean, you look at Brideshead and the makers of that completely understood what made the book the book. It's a very faithful adaptation. But with Pursuit of Love, it entirely missed the point. And it could have been any number of books of that time. I mean, conversely, did you see the John Malkovich adaptation of the ABC Murders a few years ago? That was fascinating because that took, I mean, Christie is not remotely a cult writer. She's far too mainstream. She's far too well known. Sold far too many copies. And also she wasn't writing about unfamiliar. But the ABC Murders, which is a not exceptional Hercule Poirot novel, clearly the adapter and the director took it and essentially mixed it with the grimy post-war milieu of Patrick Hamilton. And so it becomes completely different. And that was very experimental, but it worked exceptionally well. So you can turn something from the mainstream back into the cult if you have an understanding of what made it mainstream, what made it cult in the first place. But I suppose this is an issue about adaptation rather than the works themselves. And Mitford, I think, will always remain a cult writer, but these days it's because she's too posh. And that this is a thing, there's a certain sector of society now that thinks that if you are posh, you are somehow evil. And I can't comment on that, but it's something that, I mean, I always find, just on a personal level, that if some stranger on social media wants to abuse me, the word posh will come out very quickly. And you think, it's interesting because that word is used as an insult, as a curse. And you think, well, you know, good luck writing about modern day aristocracy.
Well, the secret author also in The Critic wrote a really interesting column a couple of months ago about how modern novels don't deal with middle class aspirations anymore. And that was what made a lot of Victorian and famous novels really, really like brilliant. And I think that's quite an interesting idea, that that sense of striving gives things a kind of momentum that maybe some modern novels lack. I don't know. That's a huge generalization. But it's an interesting thing to think about, that I think we're quite averse to writing and thinking about class now.
I think that books about class have been done and done well. The problem is that most novelists, most writers are middle class. There's not a lot on either side. And so while you might be writing about somebody who isn't middle class, you're writing about it with middle class aspirations and middle class interests. And of course, the trouble for me is that I review a lot of books for The Observer, but I have a monthly column. And I look at a lot to decide what to review, and I just think most of them aren't very good. These are books published by mainstream publishers, often written by quite well-known authors. But I think the quality of prose, the quality of imagination is so much weaker than it was 20 years ago. And I'm sure that that was weaker in turn than what it was 20 years before that. So the question is, I mean, are we stuck in a downward spiral? I mean, are we going to have to look to the small independent publishers with, you know, these cult writers who have these followings which have not been brought up through social media, brought up through, you know, the old-fashioned coterie system, perhaps, of readings and the work being available by subscription? I mean, perhaps that's the future. Perhaps we have to go away from the idea of novels as being this purely profitable, purely profit-driven idea, and actually look at something else. We look at the idea that the novel is itself something that can be handed from hand to hand. I mean, perhaps we go back to the court idea, and perhaps we have the idea that if you want to publish prose, you can do so chapter by chapter, that you can have a chapter and hand it around, people get excited by it again.
Or have, Ulysses was first published in lots of magazines, or as was Dickens, of course, I mean, different writers, but have chapters published by subscription is quite a fascinating idea. So bring back the Hogarth Press, bring back coterie manuscript circulation, and bring back cult writers is what we've established.
Yeah, I think that sounds absolutely ideal.
Thank you so much for talking to me. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.